wincing at the throbbing ache in his left arm. A careless wound, when he'd taken his attention off his shield for a moment, and a Volg foot soldier had managed to slice him. But at least he wasn't limping, and at least the wound the Volg prince had given him had healed. Slinging his shield over that same shoulder, he scooped up his sword and belted it at his waist, as he picked his way through the labyrinth of sleeping, exhausted bodies. A nod to Killian had the man striding for the city walls. But Adian turned left upon leaving the Great Hall, aiming for the North Tower. It was a lonely, cold walk to the room he sought, as if the entire castle were a tomb. He knocked lightly on the wooden door near the top of the tower, and it immediately opened and shut, Lysandra slipping into the hall before Evangeline could stir in her bed. In the flickering light of Adian's candle, the shadows etched on Lysandra's face from a week of fighting from sunup to sundown were starker, deeper.
Ready?
He asked softly, turning back down the stairs. It had become their tradition for him to see Lysandra upstairs at night, then come to meet her in the morning, the only bright point in their long, horrible days. Sometimes Evangeline accompanied them, narrating her time running messages and errands for Darrow. Sometimes, it was only the two of them trudging along. Lysandra was silent, her graceful gait heavier with each step they descended.
Breakfast?
Adian asked as they neared the bottom. A nod. The eggs and cured meats had given way to gruel and hot broth. Two nights ago, Lysandra had flown off in wyvern form after the fighting had ceased for the day, and returned an hour later with a heart clutched in each taloned foot. That precious meat had been gone too soon. They hit the bottom of the tower's stairwell, and Adian made to aim for the dining hall, when she stopped him with a hand on his arm. In the dimness, he turned toward her. But Lysandra, that beautiful face so tired, only slid her arms around his waist and pressed her head to his chest. She leaned enough of her weight into him that Adian set down his candle on a nearby ledge and wrapped his arms tightly around her. Lysandra sagged, leaning on him further, as if the weight of exhaustion was unbearable. Adian rested his chin atop her head and closed his eyes, breathing in her ever-changing scent. Her heartbeat thundered against his own as he ran a hand down her spine. Long, soothing strokes. They hadn't shared a bed. There was no place to do so anyway. But this, holding each other, she'd initiated it the night the 13 had sacrificed themselves, had stopped him at this very spot, and just held him for long minutes, until whatever pain and despair eased enough that they could make the trek upstairs. Lysandra pulled away, but not wholly out of his arms. Ready? We're running low on arrows, Petra Blueblood said to Manon, in the blue-gray light just before dawn. They strode through the makeshift area atop one of the castle's towers. We might want to consider assigning some of the lesser covens to stay behind today to craft more.
Do it,
Manon said, surveying the still unfamiliar wyverns who shared the space with Abraxos. Her mount was already awake, staring out, solitary and cold, toward the battlefield beyond the city walls, toward the blasted stretch of earth that no snow had been able to wipe away entirely. She'd spent hours staring at it, could barely pass over it during the endless fighting each day. Her chest, her body had been hollowed out. Only moving, going through every ordinary motion, kept her from curling up in a corner of this area and never emerging. She had to keep moving. Had to. Or else she would cease to function at all. She didn't care if it was obvious to others. Ansel of Briarcliff had sought her out in the Great Hall last night because of it. The red-haired warrior had slid onto the bench beside her, her wine-colored eyes missing none of the food that Manon had barely eaten. I'm sorry, Ansel had said. Manon had only stared at her mostly untouched plate. The young queen had surveyed the solemn hall around them. "I lost most of my soldiers," she said, her freckled face pale. "Before you arrived, Morath butchered them." It had been an effort for Manon to draw her face toward Ansel, to meet her heavy stare. She blinked once, the only confirmation she could bother to make. Ansel reached for Manon's slice of bread, pulling off a chunk and eating it. "We can share it, you know. The wastes. If you break that curse." Down the long table, some of the witches tensed, but did not look toward them. Ansel went on. "I'll honor the old borders of the Witch Kingdom, but keep the rest." The queen rose, taking Manon's bread with her. "Just something to consider, should the opportunity arise." Then she was gone, swaggering off to her own cluster of remaining soldiers. Manon hadn't stared after her, but the words, the offer, had lingered. To share the land, reclaim what they'd had, but not the entirety of the wastes. "Bring our people home, Manon." The words had not stopped echoing in her ears. "You could stay off the battlefield today, too," Petra Blueblood now said, a hand on her mount's flank. "Use the day to help the others, and rest." Manon stared at her. Even with two matrons dead, Iskra with them, and no sign of Petra's mother, the Iron Teeth had managed to remain organized, to keep Manon, Petra, and the Krokins busy. Every day, fewer and fewer walked off the battlefield. "No one else rests," Manon said coldly.
"Everyone else manages to sleep, though," Petra said.
When Manon held the witch's gaze, Petra said unblinkingly,
"You think I do not see you, lying awake all night?"
"I do not need to rest."
"Exhaustion can be as deadly as any weapon. Rest today. Then rejoin us tomorrow."
Manon bared her teeth. "The last I looked, you were not in charge." Petra didn't so much as lower her head.
"Fight, then, if that is what you wish. But consider that many lives depend on you. And if you fall because you are so tired that you become sloppy, they will all suffer for it."
It was sage advice, sound advice. Yet Manon gazed out over the battlefield, the sea of darkness just becoming visible. In an hour or so, the bone drums would beat again, and the screaming din of war would renew. She could not stop, would not stop.
"I am not resting."
Manon turned to seek out Bronwyn in the Krokin's quarters. She, at least, would not have such ridiculous notions, even if Manon knew Glennis would side with Petra. Petra sighed, the sound grating down Manon's spine.
"Then I shall see you on the battlefield."
The roar and boom of war had become a distant buzz in Evangeline's ears by midday. Even with the frigid wind, sweat ran down her back beneath her heavy layers of clothes as she made yet another sprint up the battlement stairs, message in hand. Darrow and the other old lords stood as they had these past 2 weeks, along the castle's walls, monitoring the battle beyond the city. The message she'd received, straight from a Krokin who had landed so briefly that her feet had hardly touched the ground, had come from Bronwyn. Rare, Evangeline had learned, for either the Iron Teeth or the Krokins to report anything to the humans. That the Krokin soldier had found her, had known who she was. It was pride, more than fear, that had Evangeline running up the stairs, then across the battlements to Lord Darrow. Lord Darrow, Murtaugh at his side, had already stretched out a hand by the time Evangeline slid to a stop.
"Careful," Murtaugh warned her. "The ice can be treacherous."
Evangeline nodded, though she fully planned to ignore him. Even if she'd taken a spill down the stairs yesterday that thankfully no one had witnessed.
especially Lysandra. If she'd glimpsed the bruise that now bloomed over Evangeline's leg, the matching one on her forearm, she'd have locked her in the tower. Lord Darrow read the message and frowned toward the city.
Bronwyn reports they've spotted Morath hauling a siege tower to the western wall. It will reach us in an hour or two.
Evangeline looked past the chaos on the city walls, where Adian and Wren and the Bane fought so valiantly, out beneath the melee in the skies, where witches fought witches and Lysandra flew in wyvern form. Sure enough, a massive shape was lumbering toward them. Evangeline's stomach dropped to her feet.
Is it one of those witch towers?
A siege tower is different,
Darrow said with his usual gruffness.
Thank the gods.
Still deadly, Murtaugh said, just in a different way.
The old man frowned at Darrow.
I'll head down there.
Evangeline blinked at that. None of the older lords had gone to the front.
To warn them? Darrow asked carefully.
Murtaugh patted the hilt of his sword.
Adian and Wren are stretched thin. Killian, too, if you want to keep telling yourself that he's the one leading them.
Murtaugh didn't so much as lower his chin to Darrow, who stiffened.
I'll handle the western wall and that siege tower.
A wink at Evangeline.
We can't all be brave messengers, can we?
Evangeline made herself smile, even though dread pooled in her.
Should I warn Adian that you'll be there?
I'll tell him myself,
Murtaugh said, and ruffled her hair as he walked by.
Be careful on the ice, he warned her again.
Darrow didn't try to stop him as Murtaugh walked off the battlements. Slow. He looked so slow and old and frail. And yet he kept his chin high, back straight. If she'd been able to choose a grandfather for herself, it would have been him. Darrow's face was tight when Murtaugh disappeared at last.
Old fool,
Darrow said, worry in his eyes, as he turned to the battle raging ahead. Chapter 101. Human no more. Aelin's breath rasped in her ears, her permanently arched immortal ears, with each step back toward the camped army. Rowan remained at her side, a hand around her waist. He hadn't let go of her once, not once since she'd come back, since she'd walked through worlds. She could see them still, even walking in silence under the trees, the darkness yielding toward the grayish light before dawn. She could see each and every one of those worlds she'd broken through. Perhaps she'd never stop seeing them. Perhaps she alone in this world and all others knew what lay beyond the invisible walls separating them. How much life dwelled and thrived. Loved and hated and struggled to claw out a living. So many worlds. More than she could contemplate. Would her dreams forever be haunted by them? To have glimpsed them, but been unable to explore. Would that longing take root? Oakwald's branches formed a skeletal lattice overhead, bars of a cage, as her body and this world might be. She shook off the thought. She had lived when she should have died, even if her mortal self, that had been killed, melted away. The outer edges of the camp neared, and Aelin peered down at her hands. Cold. That was a trace of cold now biting into them. Altered in every way. Dorian said as they approached the first of the Rukin,
What are you going to tell them?
The first words any of them had spoken since they'd begun the trek back here.
The truth,
Aelin said. She supposed it was all she had to offer them, after what she'd done. She said to Dorian,
I'm sorry about your father.
The chill wind brushed the strands of Dorian's hair off his brow.
So am I,
he said, resting a hand atop Damaris's hilt. At his side, Kaol kept silent, though he glanced at the king every now and then. He'd look out for Dorian, as he always had, Aelin supposed. They passed the first of the rooks, the birds eyeing them, and found Lorkin, Fenris, Gavriel, and Elide waiting by the edge of the tents. Kaol and Dorian murmured something about gathering the other royals and peeled away. Aelin remained close to Rowan as they approached their court. Fenris scanned her from head to toe, nostrils flaring as he scented her. He staggered a step closer, horror creeping across his face. Gavriel only paled. Elide gasped.
You did it, didn't you?
But it was Lorkin who answered, stiffening, as if sensing the change that had come over her.
You're not human.
Rowan snarled in warning. Aelin just looked at them. The people who'd given so much and chosen to follow her here, their doom still remaining. To succeed, and yet to utterly fail. Erewhon remained. His army remained. And there would be no Firebringer, no word keys, no gods to assist them.
They're gone?
Elide asked softly. Aelin nodded. She'd explain later. Explain it to all of them.
God killer. That's what she was, a god killer.
She didn't regret it, not one bit. Elide asked Lorkin,
Do you feel any different?
The lack of the gods who'd watched over them. Lorkin peered up at the trees overhead, as if reading the answer in their entangled branches, as if searching for Hellas there.
No,
he admitted.
What does it mean?
Gavriel mused, the first rays of sun beginning to gild his golden hair.
For them to be gone. Is there a hell realm whose throne now sits vacant?
It's too early for that sort of philosophical bullshit, Fenris said,
and offered Aelin a half-smile that didn't quite meet his eyes. Reproach lay there.
Not for her choice, but in not telling them.
Yet he still tried to make light of it.
Doomed. That lovely, wolfish grin might be in its final days of existence. They might all be in their last days of existence now.
Because of her.
Rowan read it in her eyes, her face. His hand tightened on her waist.
Let's find the others.
Standing inside one of the Coggins' fine war tents, Dorian held his hands out before a fire of his own making and winced.
That meeting could have gone better.
Kaol, seated across the fire, Irene in his lap, toyed with the end of his wife's braid.
It really could have.
Irene frowned. I don't know how she didn't walk out and leave everyone to rot. I would have.
Never underestimate the power of guilt when it comes to Aelin Galathinius,
Dorian said, and sighed. The fire he'd summoned fluttered. She sealed the word gate, Irene scowled. The least they could do is be grateful for it.
Oh, I have no doubt they are,
Kaol said, frowning now as well.
But the fact remains that Aelin promised one thing and did the opposite.
Indeed. Dorian didn't quite know what to think of Aelin's choice, or that she'd even told them about it, about trading Erewhon for Elaena, the gods betraying her in turn, and then Aelin destroying them for it.
Typical,
Dorian said, trying for humor and failing. Some part of him still felt as if he were in that place of places, especially when some part of him had been given up. The magic that had felt bottomless only yesterday now had a very real, very solid stopping point. A mighty gift, yes, but he did not think he'd ever again be capable of shattering glass castles or enemy strongholds. He hadn't yet decided whether it was a relief. It was more power, at least, than Aelin had been left with. Gifted with, it sounded like. Aelin had burned through every ember of her own magic. What she now possessed was all that remained of what Mala had given her to seal the gate, to punish the gods who had betrayed them both. The idea of it still made Dorian queasy. And the memory of Aelin choosing to throw him out of that non-place still made him grind his teeth. Not at her choice, but that his father... He'd think about his father later. Never. His nameless father, who had come for him in the end. Kaol hadn't asked about it, hadn't pushed. And Dorian knew that whenever he was ready to talk about it, his friend would be waiting. Kaol said,
Aelin didn't kill Erewhon. But at least Erewhon can never bring over his brothers. Or use the keys to destroy us all. We have that. She, you both, did that.
There would be no more callers. No more rooms beneath a dark fortress to hold them. Irene ran her fingers through Kaol's brown hair, and Dorian tried to fight the ache in his chest at the sight, at the love that flowed so freely between them. He didn't resent Kaol for his happiness, but it didn't stop the sharp slicing in his chest every time he saw them. Every time he saw the Tore healers and wished Sorsha had found them. So, the world was only partly saved, Irene said. Better than nothing. Dorian smiled at that. He adored his friend's wife already. Likely would have married her too if he'd had the chance. Even if his thoughts still drifted northward, to a golden-eyed witch who walked with death beside her and did not fear it. Did she think of him? Wonder what had become of him in Morath.
Aelin and I still have magic, Dorian said. Not like it was before, but we still have it. We're not entirely helpless. Enough to take on Erewhon?
Kaol said, his bronze eyes wary, well aware of the answer.
And Maeve?
We'll have to figure out a way,
Dorian said. He prayed it was true. But there were no gods left to pray to at all. Elide kept one eye on Aelin while they washed themselves in the queen's tent, one eye on the deliciously warm water that had been brought in, and kept warm by the woman in the tub beside her own. As if in defiance of the horrible meeting they'd had with the Khaganate royals upon Aelin's unexpected return. Triumphant, but only in some regards. One threat defeated, the other fumbled. Aelin had hit it well, but the queen had her tells too. Her utter stillness, the predatory angle of her head. The former had been present this morning. Utter stillness while she'd been questioned, criticized, shouted at. The queen had not been this quiet since the day she'd escaped Maeve. And it was not trauma that bowed her head, but guilt, dread, shame. Nearly shoulder deep in the high, long tubs, Elide had been the one to suggest a bath. To give Prince Rowan a chance to fly high and wide and take some of the edge off his temper. To give Aelin a moment to settle herself. She'd planned to bathe this morning anyway, though she'd imagined a different partner in the bath beside hers. Not that Lorcan knew that. He'd only kissed her temple before striding off into the morning to join Fenris and Gavriel in readying the army to move out, keep plunging northward. Aelin scrubbed at her long hair, the flowing mass of it draped over her body. In the light of the braziers, the tattoos on the queen's back seemed to flow like a living black river.
So, your magic is still there?
Elide blurted. Aelin slid turquoise eyes over to her. Is your water warm? Elide snorted, dragging her fingers through the water.
Yes.
You wish to know how much, exactly.
Am I allowed to know?
I wasn't lying in the meeting. Aelin said, voice still hollow. She'd stood there and taken every shouted question from Princess Hassar, every frown of disapproval from Prince Sartak.
It's...
She lifted her arms and positioned her hands in the air above each other, a foot of space between them.
Here's where the bottom was before,
she said, wriggling her lower fingers. She lifted her bottom hand until it hovered 2 inches from her top hand.
Here's where it is now.
You've tested it?
I can feel it.
Those turquoise eyes, despite all she'd done, were heavy, solemn.
I've never felt a bottom before.
Felt it without having to look for it. Aelin dunked her sudsy scalp in the water, scrubbing free the bubbles and oils.
Not so impressive, is it?
I never cared if you had magic or not.
Why? Everyone else did. A flat question. Yes, when they'd been children, so many had feared what manner of power Aelin possessed, what she'd grow into.
Who you are isn't your magic,
Elide said simply. Isn't it? Aelin rested her head on the back of the tub.
I liked my magic. Loved it.
And being human?
Elide knew she shouldn't have dared ask, but it slipped out. Aelin glanced sidelong at her.
Am I still human, deep down?
Without a human body to possess? Elide considered.
I suppose you're the only person who can decide that.
Aelin hummed, dunking under the water again. When she emerged, Elide asked,
Are you afraid of facing Erewhon in battle?
Aelin hugged her knees, her tattoo flexing across her back. She was quiet for a long while.
I am afraid of not reaching Orinth in time, she said at last.
If Erewhon chooses to drag his carcass up there to fight me, I'll deal with it then.
And Maeve? What if she arrives with Erewhon too?
But Elide knew the answer. They would die. All of them.
There had to be some way to defeat both of them.
She supposed Aneth would be of no help now. And perhaps it was time for her to rely upon herself anyway. Even if the timing could have been far better.
So many questions, Lady of Perranth.
Elide blushed and reached for the soap, scrubbing her arms down.
Sorry.
Do you now see why I didn't have you take the blood oath?
The Feymales challenge you all the time.
Yes. But I like having you not bound to me. A soft sigh.
I didn't plan for any of this.
For what?
To survive the lock. The gate. To actually have to rule. To live. I'm in uncharted territory, it seems. Elide considered, then pulled the golden ring from her finger. Silba's ring, not Mala's.
Here,
she said, extending the ring between their tubs, suds dripping off her fingers. Aelin blinked at the ring.
Why?
Because between the two of us, you're more likely to face Erewhon or Maeve.
Aelin didn't reach for it. I'd rather you keep it.
And I'd rather you have it,
Elide challenged, holding the queen's stare. She asked softly,
Haven't you given enough, Aelin? Won't you let one of us do something for you?
Aelin glanced down to the ring.
I failed. You realize that, don't you?
You put the keys back in the gate. That is not failure. And even if you had failed in that, I would give this ring to you.
I owe it to your mother to see that you survive this.
Elide's chest tightened.
You owe it to my mother to live, Aelin.
She leaned closer, practically pushing the ring into Aelin's face.
Take it. If not for me, then for her.
Aelin stared at the ring again, and then took it. Elide tried not to sigh as the queen slid it onto her finger.
Thank you,
Aelin murmured. Elide was about to answer when the tent flaps opened, icy air howling in, along with Borte. You didn't invite me for a bath? The Rukan asked, frowning dramatically at the queen. Aelin's lips curved upward. I thought Rukan were too tough for baths.
Do you see how nice the men keep their hair? You think that doesn't imply an obsession with cleanliness? Forte strode across the royal tent and plopped onto the stool beside the queen's tub, not at all seeming to care that the queen or Elide were naked. It took all of Elide's will not to cover herself up. At least with Aelin in the adjacent tub, the lip of the bath was high enough to offer them privacy. But with Forte sitting above them like this? Here are my thoughts, Forte declared, flicking the end of one of her braids. Aelin smiled slightly. Hassar is cranky and cold. Sartak is used to these conditions and doesn't care. Caution is trying to make the best of it because he's so damned nice. But they're all just a little nervous that we're marching on 100,000 soldiers, potentially more on the way, and that Erewhon is not out of commission. Neither is Maeve. So, they're pissed. They like you, but they're pissed.
I gathered as much, Aelin said dryly, when Hassar called me a stupid cow.
It had taken all of Elide's restraint not to lunge for the princess. And from the growl that had come from the Fey males, even Lorkin, gods above, she knew it had been just as difficult for them. Aelin had only inclined her head to the princess and smiled, just as she was smiling now. Forte waved off Aelin's words. Hassar calls everyone a stupid cow. You're in good company. Another smile from Aelin at that. But I'm not here to talk about that. I want to talk about you and me.
My favorite subject, Aelin said, chuckling slightly.
Forte grinned. You're alive, you made it, we all thought you'd be dead. She drew a line across her neck for emphasis, and Elide cringed. Sartak is probably going to have me leading one of the flanks into battle, but I've done that. Been good at that.
That grin widened.
I want to lead your flank.
I don't have a flank.
Then who shall you ride with into battle?
I hadn't gotten that far, Aelin said, lifting a brow. Since I expected to be dead.
Well, when you do, expect me to be in the skies above you. I'd hate for the battle to be dull. Only the fierce-eyed Rukin would have the nerve to call marching on 100,000 soldiers dull. But before Aelin could say anything, or Elide could ask Forte whether the Rooks were ready against the Wyverns, the Rook rider was gone. When Elide looked to Aelin, the queen's face was somber. Aelin nodded toward the tent flaps.
It's snowing. It's been snowing with little rest for days now.
Aelin's swallow was audible.
It's a northern snow.
The storm slammed into the camp, so fierce that Nezrin and Sartak had given the Rooks orders to hunker down for the day and night. As if crossing into Terrasen days earlier had officially put them into brutal winter.
We keep going north, Caution was saying, lounging by the fire in Hassar's sprawling tent.
Like there is another option,
Hassar snipped, sipping from her mulled wine.
We've come this far. We might as well go all the way to Orinth.
Nezrin, seated on a low sofa with Sartak, still wondered what exactly she was doing in these meetings. Wondered at the fact that she sat with the royal siblings, the heir to the Khaganate at her side.
Empress.
The word seemed to hang over her every breath, every movement. Sartak said,
Our people have faced odds like this before. We'll face them again.
Indeed, Sartak had stayed up long into the night these weeks reading the accounts and journals of Khaganate warriors and leaders from generations past. They'd brought a trunk of them from the Khaganate, for this reason. Most Sartak had already read, he'd told her. But it never hurt to refresh one's mind. If it bought them a shot against 100,000 soldiers, she wouldn't complain.
We won't be facing them at all if this storm doesn't let up, Hassar said, frowning toward her sealed tent flaps. When I return to Antica, I am never leaving again.
No taste for adventure, sister?
Kashan smiled faintly. Not when it's in a frozen hell, Hasar grumbled.
Nezrin huffed a soft laugh, and Sartak slipped his arm around her shoulders. A casual, careless bit of contact.
We keep going, Sartak said. All the way to the walls of Orinth. We swore as much, and we do not renege on our promises.
Nezrin would have fallen in love with him for that statement alone. She leaned into him, savoring his warmth, in silent thanks.
Then, let us pray, Kashan said,
that this storm does not slow us so much,
that there's nothing left of Orinth to defend.
Chapter 102. They had cleared a small chamber near the great hall for his viewing. The room lit by whatever candles could be spared. The ancient stones were cast in flickering relief around the table where they'd laid him. Lysandra lingered in the doorway, as she gazed toward the sheet-draped body at the back of the room. Ren knelt before him, head bowed, as he had done for hours now. Ever since word had come at sundown that Murtaugh had fallen. Hewn down by Volg foot soldiers as he sought to staunch their flow over the city walls, courtesy of one of their siege towers. They had carried Murtaugh back from the city wall, a throng of soldiers around him. Even from the skies, flying in with the witches after Morath had given the order to halt once more, Lysandra had heard Ren's scream. Had seen from high above as Ren ran down the battlements to the body borne through the city streets. Adian had been there within seconds, had kept Ren upright, as the young lord had sobbed, and had half carried him here, despite the fresh wounds on the prince. And so Adian had stayed, standing vigil beside Ren all this time, a hand on his shoulder. Lysandra had come with Evangeline, had held the stunned girl while she cried, and lingered while Evangeline strode to Murtaugh's body to press a kiss to his brow. As much as the sheet would allow them to see, after what the Volg had done. She had escorted her ward from the chamber, just as Darrow and the others arrived. Lysandra hadn't bothered to look at Darrow, at any of them who hadn't dared to do what Murtaugh had done. His death, they'd learned, had rallied the men at the wall, made them topple that siege tower. A lucky, costly victory. Lysandra had helped Evangeline bathe, made sure she got a hot meal, and tucked her into bed before returning. Finding Adian still beside Ren, his hand still on the kneeling lord's shoulder. So she'd lingered here, at the doorway. Her own vigil, while the well of her power refilled, while the wounds she'd sustained healed over inch by inch. Adian murmured something to Ren, and withdrew his hand. She wondered if they were his first words in hours. Adian turned toward her then, blinking, hollowed out, gutted, exhausted and grieving and bearing a weight she couldn't stand to see. Even Adian's usual stalking gait was barely more than a trudge. She followed him out, glancing back only once to where Ren still knelt, head bowed. Such terrible silence around him. Lysandra kept pace beside Adian as he turned toward the dining hall. At this hour, food would be scarce, but she'd find it, for both of them. Would go hunting if she needed to. She opened her mouth to tell Adian just that, but tears slid down his face, cutting through blood and grime. Lysandra stopped, tugging him into a halt. He didn't meet her eyes as she wiped his tears away from one cheek, then the other.
I should have been at the Western Wall, he said,
voice breaking. She knew no words would comfort him. So she wiped Adian's tears again, tears he would only show in this shadowed hall, after all others had found their beds. And when he still didn't meet her stare, she cupped his face, lifting his head. For a heartbeat, for eternity, they stared at each other. She couldn't stand it, the bleakness, the grief in his face, couldn't endure it.
Lysandra rose onto her toes and brushed her mouth over his. A whisper of a kiss, a promise of life when death hovered.
She pulled away, finding Adian's face as distraught as it had been before, so she kissed him again and lingered by his mouth as she whispered,
"He was a good man, a brave and noble man.
So are you." She kissed him a third time.
"And when this war is over, however it may end, I will still be here with you. Whether in this life or the next, Adian."
He closed his eyes, as if breathing in her words. His chest indeed heaved, his broad shoulders shaking. Then he opened his eyes, and they were pure turquoise flame, fueled by that grief and anger and defiance at the death around them. He gripped her waist in one hand, the other plunging into her hair, and tipped her head back as his mouth met hers. The kiss seared her down to her ever-changing bones, and she wrapped her arms around his neck as she held him tightly. Alone in the dark, quiet hall, death squatting on the battlefield nearby, Lysandra gave herself to that searing kiss, to Adian, unable to stop her moan as his tongue flicked against hers. The sound was his unleashing, and Adian twisted them, backing her against the wall. She arched, desperate to feel him against all of her. He growled into her mouth, and the hand at her hip slid to her thigh, hoisting it around his waist as he ground into her, exactly where she needed him. Adian tore his mouth from hers and began to explore her neck, her jaw, her ear. She breathed his name, running her hands down his powerful back as it flexed under her touch. More, 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 more of this life, this fire to burn away all shadows. More of him. Lysandra slid her hands to his chest, fingers digging into the breast of his jacket, seeking the warm skin beneath. Adian only nipped at her ear, dragged his teeth along her jaw, and seized her mouth in another plundering kiss that had her moaning again. Footsteps scuffed down the hall, along with a pointed cough, and Adian stilled. Loud. They must have been so loud. But Adian didn't budge, though Lysandra unwrapped her leg from around his waist. Just as the sentry walked past, eyes down, walked past quickly. Adian tracked the man the entire time, nothing human in Adian's eyes. An apex predator who had found his prey at last.
No, not prey, never with him, but his partner, his mate.
When the sentry had vanished around the corner, no doubt running to tell everyone what he'd interrupted, when Adian leaned to kiss her again, Lysandra halted him with a gentle hand to his mouth.
"Tomorrow," she said softly.
Adian let out a snarl, though one without any bite.
"Tomorrow,"
she said, and kissed him on the cheek, stepping out of his arms.
"Live through tomorrow, fight through tomorrow, and we'll continue."
His breathing was ragged, his eyes wary.
"Was this from pity?"
A broken, miserable question.
Lysandra slid her hand against his stubble-coated cheek and pressed her mouth against his. Let herself taste him again.
"It is because I am sick of all this death, and I needed you."
Adian made a low, pained sound. So Lysandra kissed him a final time, went so far as to run her tongue along the seam of his lips. He opened for her. And then they were tangled in each other again, teeth and tongues and hands roaming, touching, tasting. But Lysandra managed to extract herself again, her breathing as jagged as his own.
"Tomorrow, Adian,"
she breathed.
"We have enough left in our arsenal for our archers to use for another 3 days. Maybe 4 if they conserve their stores,"
Lord Darrow said, arms crossed as he read through the tally. Manon didn't dislike the old man. Part of her even admired his iron-fisted control.
but these war councils each evening were beginning to tire her, especially when they brought bleaker and bleaker news. Yesterday, there had been one more standing in this chamber, Lord Murtaugh. Today, only his grandson sat in a chair, his eyes red-rimmed, a living wraith.
Food stores, Adian asked from the other side of the table.
The General Prince had seen better days, too. They all had. Every face in this room had the same bleak, battered expression.
We have food for a month, at least, Darrow said. But none of that will matter without anyone to defend the walls.
Captain Rolf stepped up to the table.
The fire lances are down to the dregs. We'll be lucky if they last through tomorrow.
Then we can serve them, too, Manon said. Use them only for any higher-ranking Volg that make it over the city walls.
Rolf nodded.
Another man she begrudgingly admired, though his swaggering could grate. It was an effort not to look to the sealed doors to the chamber, where Astrin and Sorrel should have been waiting, defending. Instead, Petra and Bronwyn stood there, not as her new second and third, but just representatives from their own factions.
Let's say we make the arrows last for 4 days, Ansel of Briarcliff said, frowning deeply.
And make the fire lances last for 3, if used conservatively. Once they're out, what remains?
The catapults still work,
provided one of the silver-haired Fey Royals, the female one.
They're for inflicting damage far out on the field, though, said Prince Galen,
who, like Adian, bore Aelin's eyes.
Not close fighting.
Then we have our swords,
Adian said hoarsely.
Our courage.
The latter, Manon knew, was running low, too.
We can keep the Iron Teeth at bay, Manon said, but cannot also aid you at the walls.
They were indeed fighting a relentless tide that did not diminish.
So, is this the end, then?
Ansel asked.
In 4 or 5 days, we offer our necks to Morath?
We fight to the last of us, Adian growled. To the very last one.
Even Lord Darrow did not object to that. So they departed, meeting over. There wasn't anything else to discuss. Within a few days, they'd all be a grand feast for the crows.
Chapter 103. The storm had halted their army entirely. On the first morning, it raged so fiercely that Rowan hadn't been able to see a few feet before him. Rooks had been grounded, and only the hardiest of scouts had been sent out, on land. So the army sat there, not 50 miles over Terrasen's border, a week from Orinth. Had Aelin possessed her full powers? Not her full powers. Not anymore, Rowan reminded himself, as he sat in their war tent, his mate and wife and queen on the low-lying sofa beside him. Aelin's full powers were now... he didn't quite know. Where they'd been at Mistward, perhaps, when she still had that self-inflicted damper. Not as little as when she'd arrived, but not as much as when she'd encircled all of Doranel with her flame. Certainly not enough to face Erewhon and walk away. And Maeve. He didn't care. Didn't give a shit whether she had all the power of the sun or not an ember. It had never mattered to him anyway. Outside, the wind howled, the tent shuddering.
Is it always this bad?
Fenris asked, frowning at the shaking tent walls.
Yes,
Elide and Aelin said, then shared a rare smile.
A miracle, that smile on Aelin's mouth.
But Elide's faded as she said,
This storm could last days. It could dump 3 feet.
Lorcan, lingering near the brazier, grunted.
Even once the snow stops, there will be that to contend with. Soldiers losing toes and fingers to the cold and wet.
Aelin's smile vanished entirely. I'll melt as much as I can. She would. She'd bring herself to the edge of a burnout to do it. But together, if they linked their powers, the force of Rowan's magic might be enough to melt a path, to keep the army warm.
We'll still have an army who arrives at Orinth exhausted, Gavriel said, rubbing his jaw.
How many days had Rowan seen him gaze northward, toward the son who fought in Orinth, wondering, no doubt, if Adian still lived?
They're professionals, Fenris said dryly. They can handle it. Going the long way around will only increase the exhaustion, Lorcan said. The last we heard, Rowan said, Morath held Perranth.
A pained wince from Elide at that.
We won't risk crossing too close to it. Not when it would mean potentially getting entangled in a conflict that would only delay our arrival in Orinth and thin our numbers.
I've looked at the maps a dozen times.
Gavriel frowned to where they were laid out on the work table.
There's no alternative way to Orinth. Not without drawing too close to Perranth.
Perhaps we'll be lucky, Fenris said, and this storm will have hit the entire north. Maybe freeze some of Morath's forces for us.
Rowan doubted they'd be that lucky. He had a feeling that any luck they possessed had been spent with the woman sitting beside him. Aelin looked at him, grave and tired. He could not imagine what it felt like. She had yielded all of herself, had given up her humanity, her magic. He knew it was the former that left that haunted, bruised look in her eyes, that made her a stranger in her own body. Rowan had taken the time last night to reacquaint her with certain parts of that body, and his own, had spent a long while doing so too, until that haunted look had vanished, until she was writhing beneath him, burning while he moved in her. He hadn't stopped his tears from falling, even when they'd turned to steam before they hit her body, and there had been tears on her own face, bright as silver in the flame, while she'd held him tight. Yet this morning, when he'd nuzzled her awake with kisses to her jaw, her neck, that haunted look had returned and lingered. First her scars, then her mortal human body. Enough. She had given enough. He knew she planned to give more. A Rukan scout called for the queen from the tent flaps, and Aelin gave a quiet command to enter. But the scout only poked in her head, her eyes wide. Snow covered her hood, her eyebrows, her lashes.
Your Majesty and Majesties, she corrected, glancing at him.
Rowan didn't bother to tell her he was simply and would forever be Your Highness.
You must come.
The scout panted hard enough for her breath to curl in the chilled air leaking through the tent flaps.
All of you.
It took minutes to don their warmer layers and gear, to brace for the snow and wind. But then they were all inching through the drifts, the scout guiding them past half-buried tents. Even under the trees, there was little shelter. Yet then they were at the edge of the camp, the blinding snows roaring past, veiling what the scout pointed to as she said,
Look!
At his side. Aelin stumbled a step. Rowan reached for her to keep her from falling. But she hadn't been falling. She'd been lurching forward, as if to run ahead. Rowan saw at last what she beheld, who emerged between the trees. Against the snow, he was nearly invisible with his white fur, would have been invisible were it not for the golden flame flickering between his proud, towering antlers. The Lord of the North. And at his feet, all around him, the little folk. Snow clinging to her lashes, a small sound came out of Aelin as the creature nearest curled its hand, beckoning, as if to say,
Follow us.
The others gaped in silence at the magnificent proud stag who had come to greet them, to guide home the Queen of Terrasen.
but then the wind began to whisper. And it was not the song that Rowan usually heard. No. It was a voice that they all heard as it streamed past them.
Doom is upon Orinth, heir of Brannan. You must hurry.
A chill that had nothing to do with the cold skittered down Rowan's skin. The storm, Aelin blurted, the words swallowed by the snow.
You must hurry. We will show you the way, swift and unseen.
Aelin only stilled, said to that voice, as ancient as the trees, as old as the rocks between them.
You have already helped me so many times.
And you have given much yourself, heir of Brannan. We who remember him know he would have made such a choice, had he been able to do so. Oakwald shall never forget Brannan, or his heir.
Aelin straightened, scanned the trees, the snow-whipped wind. Dryad. That was the word he sought. Dryad, a tree spirit.
What is your cost?
Aelin asked, her voice louder now. Do you really want to ask? Fenris muttered. Rowan snarled at him. But Aelin had gone still as she waited for the dryad to answer. The voice of Oakwald, of the little folk and creatures who had long cared for it.
A better world,
the dryad replied at last.
Even for us.
The army was a flurry of activity as it hauled itself into preparing to march, to race northward. But Aelin dragged Rowan into their tent, to the pile of books Kaol and Irene had brought from the southern continent. She ran a finger over the titles, searching, scanning.
What are you doing? Her mate asked.
Aelin ignored the question and hummed as she found the book she sought. She leafed through it, careful not to tear the ancient pages. A stupid cow I might be, she muttered, rotating the book to show Rowan the page she sought. But not without options. Rowan's eyes danced.
You're including me in this particular scheme, princess?
Aelin smirked. I wouldn't want you to feel left out. He angled his head.
We need to hurry, then.
Listening to the ruckus of the readying army beyond their tent, Aelin nodded and began. Chapter 104. The sweat and blood on him quickly freezing, Adian panted as he leaned against the battered city walls and watched the encamped enemy pull back for the night. A sick sort of joke, a cruel torment for Morath to halt at each sundown, as if it were some sort of civility, as if the creatures who infested so many of the soldiers below required light. He knew why Erewhon had ordered it so. To wear them down day by day. To break their spirits, rather than let them go out in raging glory. It wasn't just the victory or conquest that Erewhon desired, but their complete surrender. Their begging for it to be over, for him to end them, rule them. Adian ground his teeth as he limped down the battlements, the light quickly fading, the temperature plummeting. 5 days. The weapons they'd estimated running out in 3 or 4 days had lasted until today. Until now. Down the wall, one of the Mycenaeans sent a plume of flame onto the Volg still trying to scale the siege ladder. Where it burned, demons fell away. Rolf stood by the woman wielding the fire lance, his face as bloodied and sweaty as Adian's. A black armored hand clamped onto the battlement beside Adian as he passed by, grappling for purchase. Barely looking, Adian slammed out his ancient shield. A yelp and fading cry was his only confirmation that the rogue soldier had gone tumbling to the ground. Rolf smiled grimly as Adian halted, the weight of his armor like 1,000 stones. Overhead, Crokins and Ironteeth flew slowly back across the city walls, red capes drooping over brooms, leathery wings beating irregularly. Adian watched the sky until he saw the riderless wyvern he looked for every day, every night. Spotting him too, Lysandra banked and began a slow, pained descent toward the city wall. So many dead. More and more each day. Those lost lives weighed his every step. Nothing he could do would ever make it right. Not really.
The archers are out, Adian said to Rolf by way of greeting,
as Lysandra drew closer, blood both her own and from others on her wings, her chest.
No more arrows.
Rolf jerked his chin toward the Mycenaean warrior still setting off her fire lance in sputtering fits and bursts. Lysandra landed, shifting in a flash, and was instantly at Adian's side, tucked under his shield arm. A soft, swift kiss was their only greeting. The only thing he looked forward to every night. Sometimes, once they'd been bandaged and eaten something, he'd managed to get more than that. Often they didn't bother to wash up before finding a shadowed alcove. Then it was nothing but her, the sheer perfection of her, the small sounds she made when he licked up her throat, when his hands slowly, so slowly, explored each inch of her, letting her set the pace, show him and tell him how far she wished to go. But not that final joining, not yet. Something for them both to live for. That was their unspoken vow. She reeked of Volg blood, but Adian still pressed another kiss to Lysandra's temple before he looked back at Rolf. The pirate lord smiled grimly, well aware that these would likely be their final days. Hours. The Mycenaean warrior aimed her fire lance again, and the lingering Volg tumbled away into the darkness, little more than melted bones and fluttering cloth.
That's the last of it,
Rolf said quietly. It took Adian a heartbeat